What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. Okay, we haven't had him on for a minute, but when we have economic questions, number crunching questions, he wants to talk about elections, but he can't fool us. He's an economist. He works for one of them four-letter, not three-letter, government organizations. Stephen Popick, how are you, sir?
Doing great, and I'm repping the Atlanta Falcons for Monday Night Football.
Oh, you see, I love Falcons fans and Atlanta people because they're one tier up from like Jet and Cowboys fans. Like they understand there's going to be an up and down, but yeah, you get a win and then you get a little, you know, got to get them back down.
Hey, one tier up from Jets and Cowboys fans. I'll take it today.
That's Dr. 28-3 to you, Dr. Stephen Popick.
Did you hear we're going to get Super Bowl 28?
If we don't, I said it the last
time. Super Bowl in 2028.
If we don't get an outcast reunion for the Super Bowl, you blew it. You know, it's just that simple. All right.
I'm there with you.
Let's talk some economics real quick. You were joking about it online. You had your account locked, so I had to send it out and claim it was my own, but I did give you credit. Unexpectedly, the economy grew exactly how much everybody had expected it to be for about a month. So here we go again. Look, we're 40 odd days from the election is where the economy is always going to be a hot button. What is the economy right now today in a bite-sized amount? Good, bad, indifferent, trending one way or the other? What is this economy? Because nobody can seem to define it for me.
So, Andrew, right now we're seeing inflation has been brought down to levels that I think we would be comfortable with going forward. We're still seeing real wage growth. We see unemployment still being low. Yes, there's been an uptick, but consider that, you know, that we generally view less than 5% unemployment to be really darn good, and we're still somewhere in the fours, depending on how you measure it. So this economy is going really well right now, I would say. I think that's the sort of consensus. Now, if you talk with me sometime next week, there might be a completely different answer.
And stuff. Obviously, there could be a world event. There could be a conflict, something like that. Economically, though, what else is kind of floating around out there that we could hit?
You know, I mean, I think the other risks that we have are more in the medium term right now. You know, still looking at a sizable proportion of the workforce, you know, retiring at some point. You know, the baby boomers and those folks that have sort of delayed and deferred retirement from COVID and lockdown, when people stayed on their jobs a little longer than we thought. So, I mean, you're looking at, you know, a shift in who's actually working. So that's a tension that we'll see playing out regardless of whoever is elected, right? You'll see folks that'll be highly experienced, know who to talk to in the organizations to get things done. And those folks will be retiring in droves. And then to replace them, you have to bring in new to the workforce folks. You're still seeing private companies and the government struggle with what to do with this return to office. You know, there's a big struggle right now that was public about Amazon, where they said, hey, you know how we said you're going to be in the office 2 days a week? Psych, 5 days, you know. And And the employees are there are unhappy, but, you know, they're not going to be able to do anything aside from being unhappy at this point. But, you know, we're still seeing that struggle. We still have a housing market that is unable to produce enough housing for people to live in. And close to my neck of the woods here in D.C., a proposal that was at a neighboring county, Arlington County, to sort of incentivize building these sorts of smaller homes. They call it missing middle, but think about townhomes, row homes, you know, condos, things like that, was just struck down by the local courts here to say, nope, you can't do that. You can't have this kind of zoning on technicalities. And that's frustrating because we're, you know, they're trying to use their very limited land to actually build housing. Because if you basic econ 101, sometimes it's right. If you don't build stuff, if you don't supply things, the price of what is out there keeps going up. And that's why we got a lot of folks out there that are like locked out of buying a home.
Yeah. And if you can't build outward, you got to build upward. And then this is where the NIMBY YIMBY thing gets to some nitty gritty beyond the online. And I'm sensitive to this too, is people are like, okay, if you start building apartment buildings and townhouses and row houses, you're changing the character of neighborhoods. Totally get that. Understand that. Understand their point on it. But when you have areas like, you know, a DC suburb, I spent a lot of time in Atlanta last year, and I was down there every other weekend for about 4 months. And every other weekend when I went down there, there was more construction going up, or another layer on the apartments, or another layer of row homes getting closer to the, like, it's almost like driving through canyons now, just row homes, apartment buildings, townhouses. That's your only option. So you can say YIMBY and NIMBY and all this stuff, but the fact of the matter is, if you just have a zoning law where it says residential, no multifamily units or multi-units or however it's phrased, that's the death nail to all of it. And that's the gritty detail where people don't talk about that. And that has an effect on things. We're talking about elections. That has an effect on elections. It has effect on
Democrats. It has a big effect on elections, Andrew. Look at Texas. Now, look, Texas is, in my opinion, a folly's errand for the Democrats to try to pick up this year with, Allred and Cruz and whatnot. But it's closer than it was 4 years
Cruz.
Ago.
They're not going to flip the state blue, but they, at some point they're going to clip Cruz because nobody likes Cruz. But it's not going to turn the state blue. I think that's a distinction to make.
But what I'm trying to say in this is that you've seen, because of a lack of ability to build housing out in California, remember over 90% of land in San Francisco is single-family zoned only. They literally can't build up and build dense. The local councils are not allowing it. This is a local government problem, not a national government, even a state government problem. And so with no place to live in their big cities, Californians have been moving to Arizona and Texas, which seem to have an ability because they have a lot of land and don't really care about sprawling because they love their cars, to just build homes, right? And so that is where homes are actually available and purchasable and moderately more affordable. And you know, that also, as I said, that has election consequences. You're in some sense, it's right. You're going to start, you know, diluting, for lack of a better word, the Dem partisan lead in California, because folks are moving out to Texas and Arizona and Colorado and New Mexico and other places, you know, and they're coming into more so red areas, because the red areas in the Midwest are the ones that are able to build homes.
Let me give you another example, and it's from your neck of the woods, but the D.C. area, you know, Nova, Alexandria, Virginia, Maryland, West Virginia Panhandle. The West Virginia Panhandle has become one of the most politically powerful parts of West Virginia because it's one of the places that is growing. Now, they have really pretty strict stuff in a lot of parts of the West Virginia Panhandle that's part of the D.C. metro. And for folks that don't know, you know, the Maryland rail line, you can go from, you know, Union Station, downtown D.C., straight to Martinsburg, West Virginia now. Like, that's the last stop on the line. It's a big deal. And I personally know a lot of D.C. people that have moved to Martinsburg.
And parts of the West Virginia, right, are considered to be part of the D.C. metropolitan area.
Yeah, but now West Virginia, because the middle part of the state has been hollowed out and the coal fields down south are dying. Traditionally, the southern coal fields is where you go political power. Now it's Charleston, Morgantown, WVU, and the Panhandle. That's where all the population growth is. that's the center. So, and the guy that's going to, you know, Patrick Morrissey is going to become the new governor unless something screwy happens. He lives in Harper's Ferry. You know, we're seeing more and more political power in a state like West Virginia because of its proximity to D.C. And a lot of it has to do with just growth and housing and zoning. And they have pretty strict zoning laws in the panhandle that they've been very smart about. Mm-hmm. They've made it slow growth. But over the last 20, 25 years, it's just inexorable. It's going to grow, and it's changed the political layout of a place like West Virginia. And you don't think of it, but that's very much a housing driven change.
Yep. People got to live somewhere, Andrew.
Yeah, I know. I'd like to see it.
At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
Let me ask you about data for a second, because you sent me a chart and I found it very interesting. We're going to intersperse it into the video if you're watching.
I don't have to pull it up. That's fantastic.
No, well, you won't be able to see it, but I'll put it in.
I got to hear it on my side monitor anyway, so we're
there. Good. You go. The magic of post-production, the audience will get to see it. If you're watching on the iTunes or the Spotify or whatever, go to the YouTube or the herdtell.substack.com. And you'll be able to see this graph. But this is interesting to me because here's my thing. When I look at polls, and I've been saying this on the program, I don't really go off the national average poll because I think it's basically worthless. The only thing it's really useful for is like a momentum type of thing. You can kind of get maybe who's got momentum, who doesn't. But the actual national average polling is pretty much worthless. I look at the swing state polling because we do have an electoral college, so I don't know why we're wasting our time on popular vote. I look at the swing states. I look at a few other metrics like women, like education, the Hispanic vote, the African-American vote. I look at those polling numbers. And then you have pointed out something about that rolling national average, about how some of it is accurate, some of it makes sense. But then there's also this thing where we've got a lot of random data where we're just trying to get a line to go straight across. Yeah. It. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, I have two concerns about how we use polling. When we talk about elections, number one, if you're talking about what's happening with the Hispanic vote in this country, for example, just to pull a random one, and you're using the crosstabs from these national polls or state polls to tell you how Hispanics are voting, that is fundamentally flawed. The polls that you're citing, so let's just leave in the world of national polls, right? And I'll grant you that state level polls are much better for getting what's happening at the state level, and I'm with you on that. Let's take national level polls. You know, it gives you, they're designed to get an accurate estimate of what the top line is, right? Harris has X, Trump has Y. That's what they're designed to do. They are not designed to then say, and how do Hispanics across the U.S. view it? How do women across the U.S. view it? How do coal miners view this? They're not designed for those subpopulations. So the weighting that these polls have to be an accurate reflection of the electorate that's anticipated, right? The weighting breaks down at these subgroup levels. And so you'll get these crosstabs. They might say 70% of Hispanics are supporting Harris and 30% are supporting Trump. And I just made up those two numbers. The actual truth is actually, if you think about it, like looking at it, it would be 45% to 95% of Hispanics are supporting Harris. Right, there's a wide confidence interval there, wide errors. So then we get into this notion of, you say, I'm gonna watch the national polls for trends, and the chart that I shared on Twitter is saying don't do that. I disagree fundamentally with a lot of the pollster predictions and the Nate Silvers, the Nate Cohns, and the G. Elliott Morrises of the world on how they're using these polls, because I can't go and I haven't gone into inspecting the the Stata code or the R code and these models and whatnot. But what I showed you, what I have on my Twitter, which is Motoconomist at twitter.com, I have a post up that says, let's envision a world in which the national vote is 48% Harris, 48% Trump, and the other 4% are voting for Jill Stein or, RFK Jr. or Cornelius West or whatever, right? You know, who cares? And I said, let's have that. And then let's take polls. Let's just see, you know, we know what the margin of errors on the on these polls are, right? So let's just set a margin of error of 3, which applies to both estimates of the candidates, right? So a margin error of 3 applies to Harris and it applies to Trump. And let's see what happens. And so I made this graphic of like, here's a time series of 40 polls is what I did. And I got blue dots and I got red dots, right? So you can see what vote Trump got and what vote Harris got. And fundamentally, the truth is that they both have 48% support. And when you look at the first chart that I shared, you know, I showed the trend line of what was going on, and the trend line is exactly what you would expect. It's pretty darn flat, right? You can give it a fudge factor. You could say Kamala Harris has increased her support by 0.5% and Trump has lost 0.5%. You can do that. You'll still barely see a change on the line. But then I do something where I say, you know, a lot of these polling aggregation sites say we use the most recent polls and we sort of drop off the polls that, you know, have had a lot of time out there, right? Sort of a moving average. So then I took that same random draws and I said, here's your 7-day moving average of these polls. And we start off the period where, for luck of the draw, Donald Trump is polling at 51% and Harris is down at 47%. And then as time passes, Harris surges to 50 and Trump declines down to 45. And then Trump surges back up to 49 and Harris declines to 49. The point being, there was never any movement in that data. We are fooling ourselves, thinking that there was a change in the fundamentals of the election just based on when the polls dropped. And I think that is, I think, the disservice that a lot of these, you know, sort of polling prediction sites have. They give you, some just give you a line that says, here's our predicted electoral votes. Here's our predicted, you know, support for Harris. And you just see 48 or 272 or whatever. They don't show you the confidence intervals, the errors, right? Because what you'd see is, I think some Twitter commentator said, so my prediction of 48, 46, and it's really close, you know, holds true. Like, and I won't even say which candidate has 48 and which one has 46. Like, yeah, you know, because if with this 48-48 split, you're going to get estimates. I think this is what I really want to drive home here. You'll get a poll, right, that has Kamala Harris up at 54 percentage point support. Trump obviously much lower, but then on the flip, you'll see Trump at 54. And Kamala Harris down at 42, right? And you'll see all these things, and we infer momentum, and we infer change, and I'm not certain that we really can do that. I think there are some folks that put the error bars out there and says, here's our confidence around these things, and you can see right now there's a lot of purple in these because you got a bunch of blue confidence intervals, you know, alongside red confidence intervals. They're sort of overlapping, so it looks purple. It just tells you this is a really close election, right? And I think that if anyone else is saying anything differently, they just fundamentally are not understanding polls. Like, people are unskewing the polls by looking at the crosstabs and saying this poll is wrong because there's way too many Republicans or way too many Democrats. It wasn't designed for that. Don't unskew the polls, and don't fool yourself into thinking that that even a change from Ipsos from Harris plus 4 to Harris plus 7 shows Harris momentum. That could simply just be random noise.
Yeah, and here's the other thing. Stephen Popick joining us. When I look at the polling, and I've been talking about this, and I've tried to be consistent about it, I keep telling people, and they keep getting mad at me, I'm like, Harris is behind in this race. Vice President Kamala Harris, I mean. She's behind in this race, and she's underperforming. And people get really mad at me, like, well, how you can't say that. I'm like, hold on a second. Here's where the skew came. They went from, and you can tell me the data, I'm telling you what I'm watching. They went from no hope when Joe Biden fell apart to, oh my gosh, we got hope. And you got this momentum and enthusiasm surge because you went from nothing to normal. So basically she put the old coalition back together. So you went from nothing to normal, but because it was nothing and everybody was despairing, it was a big enthusiastic thing. Totally understand that. But when I look at the polling, not the national averages, I'm looking at the breakdown. Let's take that NBC poll from the weekend that everybody was looked very good for VP Harris. Looked very good for her. She was behind Biden's 2020 levels with Hispanics. She was behind Biden's 2020 levels with African Americans. She was barely by 1 point better than him in 2020 with women.
So, she can't win like that. I got to stop you there because you're diving into the crosstabs of these polls. You have to understand that there are wide errors. There are much larger errors in either direction, right? If you were to go diving into those crosstabs, right? Saying Harris
is 5-7 instead of 2-3 on the margins. Because they go to like 5-7% margin of error instead of like a 2-3 on the overall.
So my point is, you could look at the crosstab and say, oh, Harris is behind with women by 1 point. Pure random chance. That is what that could be. And I think highly likely that it is. She could be just as likely to be, I mean, almost like she could be +1. She could be +2. She could be -4, right? It is hard for me to make that inference unless we have a poll. Give me a national poll. That is, we are surveying Hispanic voters. We are surveying female voters, and we're going to get the estimate for female voters, and we're not interviewing a single man. And here's how we're going to weight this stuff, and here's how we're going to get an estimate of, you know, women's support for Harris or Trump. That's what we're going to do. That's an ideal poll. But to dive into these crosstabs that have much wider margins of error, you know, you are confusing direction with randomness. The fact that, you know, people say that there's momentum because Trump was +1 in this poll last month and now is +2 this month, he's gained a point. My point that I'm trying to make is that's probably a mirage. It's hard to conceive, at least from my worldview, a highly polarized electorate seeing massive swings in support for either of these two candidates. Changes are, you know, you could be picking up maybe it's enthusiasm of who's responding. I'm always concerned about non-response bias. You have to wait your way out of it, and you're guessing. And if you're using the waiting scheme from the past election, you're probably wrong. But I think there's so much going on there. So, like, fundamentally, we won't know how people really voted until after the election, and we get those exit polls. And then we can say, you're going to answer truthfully, did Harris pull the old coalition back together, or did she not? You know, I agree with you. I think this election is razor tight. You know, that's what that's my viewpoint when I look at these things. You know, I think that, you know, we have a lot of stuff to come in the last month. We know October changes things. That's why we have October surprises. And you know, it's going to come down, you know, to election day. I don't think we're going to have a clear sense. Even if you tell me, you know, Harris has, you know, 60% chance on election day, you know, I don't know if that's, I wouldn't call that her being favored. I think that's pretty much dead even heat at that point. And then we're not going to find out who actually won the election until several days later, because when we're talking about these swing states, right? If you look back at 2020, it was multiple days after election day before they finally got done processing all their absentee ballots, all their provisional ballots, all the things that were left over for these states to do to determine what is the actual vote count for the two candidates. So I hope nobody's staying up on Tuesday night expecting to know the winner at midnight, I think you're going to know, you know, you're going to say, oh, it's really close in Pennsylvania. Shocker. We'll have to wait a few days to find out who won Pennsylvania. Now, of course, if you start seeing some, you know, if the polls have been wrong, right, if we're seeing a massive polling error, then we'll know on election night. Sure. But probably we won't know until Thursday or Friday about who's actually winning.
This is not encouraging for somebody like me that has to sit on TV talking heading on Tuesday night late, but I'll take it under advisement. Let me ask
you
this.
Good caveat for you, sir. Just a good caveat for you so that, you know, you look intelligent on that TV show, you know. Hedge your bets. Be an economist on the one hand, but on the other, you know.
I got to figure out a way to say I don't know six different ways over the course of 2 hours.
Yes,
basically.
You do. Yeah,
that's the burden of being a talking head.
It's going to be close.
It's going to be close. Well,
it's going to be close,
especially when I'm doing overseas media. Stephen Popick, let me throw you this one because I don't think this is a quantifiable thing with a number. You mentioned enthusiasm. I mentioned enthusiasm. I think there's an aspect to this election people aren't talking about where I don't think there's actually that much enthusiasm. I really don't. I think it's people are kind of settled. I know people got excited about Kamala Harris because Biden went from competent to incompetent to, oh my God, what are we going to do? And all the Democrats freaked out. Now they feel good. Ooh. Like they got a chance. Even Trump people have got to start having fatigue in year nine of the Trump era. Like I don't see as much enthusiasm for him as it. I think enthusiasm is the wrong way. I think some of the weird numbers we're seeing is because maybe people just they're going through the motions of enthusiasm, but there ain't actually a whole lot of enthusiasm underneath.
So there's actually some good data on that. I won't go into.
Well, thank God, because you left me out on a limb on that last one.
There is some data on that, and it actually sort of backs up what you're thinking, Andrew. When we look at the early vote returns right now from a lot of states, what we're seeing, by and large, is bipartisan apathy, if I can phrase it that way. We're seeing, you know, looking at the early returns, sort of extrapolating out what we think the total turnout's going to be. It looks like both Democratic-leaning voters and Republican-leaning voters, right now they're just not as interested in this election. So, will that hold up for a whole month? Who knows? But the early indications are it is not enthusiasm. And I think more of it is maybe the question, Andrew, is who wins this election, is who convinces the folks to trudge off of their butts from the sofa, you know, and just shuffle down and cast their vote and just sort of mumble under their breath the whole way there and back.
This is a big deal, though, what you're talking about, because, and here's why I say I think Harris is behind and needs to play catch up, and her team should act like she's behind.
I agree that her team should act from behind, but like I want to say, I disagree with you that Harris is behind right now. I think she's ahead, but I think it's, you know, if I were to give election odds today, I call it 53-47 for Harris, which is functionally, as I said, wide error bars. If you're sitting here telling me, well, Stephen, I think it's 53-47 Trump, I would go, we're both probably equally right. You know, like, I could see that.
But I have to work off of historical record what I know. What's the one thing I know about the Trump as a candidate? High floor, low ceiling. His base is going to show up. Now, where's that? Is that base 46, 47, 48%? It's somewhere in that range. His base is going to turn out. I know for a fact his base is going to turn out. So if you have a depressed enthusiasm election, which is this is kind of heading to, although I still think, look, if you put a gun in my head today, who wins, I'd say Harris, and here's why. I think there is going to be a surge of people who are just fed up and don't consume media and don't talk to media, and I think they're going to wind up showing up in the election in certain places. But might be wrong about that. That would be a margin call, but that's where I'm at on this.
Harris wins if she goes on Hot Ones.
Oh, come on, stop. Here's you're looking at this electoral map, though, and you're a numbers guy.
I am.
She could win the entire Rust Belt and still lose because the Sun Belt's just more people and Trump's stronger there. Like the electoral map we're dealing with is very different now.
Well, if she wins the blue wall states and any two, she wins the election.
I look at states like I know people are head. You talked about Texas earlier. I think we've heard the same thing about North Carolina for a while. I know demographically at some point it's going to flip back. I know a lot about North Carolina politics. Is it going to be this year? I don't know. If they do get it, it would be razor thin. I don't think you could even call it a.
No, I'm not including Arizona, North Carolina, and Georgia in Harris's column.
Well, Georgia is going to be a mess because, like the last time, man, if Georgia's close, Georgia's going to make Florida 2000 look like a picnic because it's going to be ugly, and they're preparing to make Georgia ugly. Pennsylvania, but like you said, you get Pennsylvania wrapped up, you get Arizona, you get a couple of these others, you may not have to worry about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're doing the election night thing, right? If you start looking at what happens in North Carolina, and I think Steve Kornacki had a really good piece in 2020 and 2016 when he was showing what was happening in some of these precincts on various places, and very early on saying, I think, you know, showing that Trump was a lot stronger than people thought and things were trending his direction. And he was saying that like at 8:30 at night, you know, so I think he did a pretty good job of reading the data. If you're watching some of these precincts and you're seeing how they turn out, looking back at 2020, that could give you an early sense as to where, say, like a North Carolina might happen. And so a surprise would be North Carolina getting called, right? Or seeing the direction that North Carolina is going. That's the state I'm watching in this election, because it's going to tell me a bit about, it's going to tell me Georgia, a bit about Georgia, right? And I'm not going to find out Pennsylvania for 5 days, so I can't really watch Pennsylvania because that's my prediction on Pennsylvania. So I think North Carolina is the state to watch.
I think you watch it for another reason. I think this election, we're going to have more split ticketing than we've seen in a long, long time.
Oh, in North Carolina, you definitely will.
And North Carolina is going to be the center of it, as is Arizona because of the Senate race. North Carolina is different because you have the lieutenant governor situation. Mark Robinson, we covered it on another program. If you don't know the ins and outs of it, I'm not going to weed into that filth right now. Just go to Hurtel. Pull it up. You can hear my rant about Mark.
We can do better as a country than nominating folks like this.
Look, he was already losing he was consistently in the double digits down to Josh Stein anyway. He was already going to lose. By the way, people, be adults. The code red that got called on Mark Robinson didn't come from the liberal media. It came from the Republican Party. Just trust me on that one, okay? That's why everybody's bailing out, because that came from
this is Andrew letting us know what's happening from here, you know?
I'm not at liberty to discuss it. I'm just anybody that's telling you Mark Robinson got took out by the left is wrong. No, he didn't. He got took out by the right, but we'll talk about that. There'll be a post-mortem for that. Anyway, the point is, Robinson's so bad. There's this big debate about, can the under ticket drag down the top of the ticket? And we don't really have conclusive data on that one way or the other, because it really hasn't happened that much. This is going to be a test case for that, because Robinson is so toxic now. He's going to lose that race so badly to, all due respect to Josh Stein, but he's just kind of the next man up. He's not real exciting. He's not doing anything, but he's going to win this in a blowout. Does it drag Trump down in North Carolina? That's one of those things to look at. And then one of the other things is, uh-huh, North Carolina has been the epicenter for gerrymander redistricting law. Look, I had to vote in the same election three times at one point a couple of years ago because they kept changing it. They had to keep doing the election over and over again. And it's ground zero. Look, one person's gerrymandering is another person's redistricting, Morgan. And now it's ground zero for the voter purge, quote unquote. I'll put air quotes around voter purge. Mm-hmm. The voter purge stuff. So we have all three of those stories in North Carolina, and I think all three of those are going to be worth watching come election night. Is it going to drag Trump with the Mark Robinson stuff? Is the demographics going to really change? And the voter purge stuff, those are all things worth watching in North Carolina, because I think the split ticketing may be the story of this whole election.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the voter purge, because I wanted to briefly touch on that. So, you know, what made the social media rounds is that North Carolina has purged supposedly, you know, a large chunk of people off of its voter rolls, just in time for the 2024 election. Okay, that's not true. North Carolina has purged a lot of people over the last 2 years, consistent with existing federal law on voter list maintenance. These are folks that move out of the state. They die. You know, their addresses, you know, can't be found. Normal stuff. It's not, you know, I think, you know, when it's been reported, you know, they report North Carolina's purged. I'm correct me if I'm wrong. I think it's 800,000 is what the claim was, purged off the rolls. But the headlines all say purges 800,000. And at least the Twitterverse and some media say that, oh, that, you know, that must have been in the last few months up leading up to this election. The fix is in North Carolina, folks. No. It's 800,000 purged since the last election in North Carolina, which is in 2022. You know, and North Carolina is a pretty big state. It's got some pretty big cities in it, you know. And that is, I think, you know, by and large, normal voter list maintenance occurring. You can look at some of the data and you can see how many people were purged for being deceased and how many were purged because they moved out of state, which is the vast majority of these folks that were dropped from the voter rolls. I'm not convinced that that's a particular issue that's going to sway anything, you know. So,
well, part of the voter
and role. Andrew, I'll mention, you know, I sort of looked at the stuff when I was at DOJ for a bit more than a cup of coffee under Bush's second term, 43, I should say, and Obama's first term. 44, you know, and we looked at that stuff. So I have some experience in understanding sort of what happens with these sort of requirements on voter list maintenance that are set out on the National Voter Registration Act and things like that.
One thing about this, Stephen Poppe joining us, the one thing you got to talk about these voter purges is like, well, they always do this right before election. Yes, they do it right before election, but here's why. Because you have a surge of registrations and changes and address changes and stuff mm-hmm. for the primary season. And also, this is when the election boards and the staff, when they're staffed up to actually go through and do this stuff.
That's right.
And then
that's
they're trying to get it done. They're trying to get it done before the general election because they have all this new, because remember, a lot of primary voters, they're walking in with it. And that's where you get, oh, well, you'll get a new card in the week. And, you know, they'll go to the voter table where you're getting registered and they'll change their crap and they'll work with them. And they say, you'll get it in 2 weeks. They're trying to get that cleaned up. It's because of the primary season and the surge that they have to surge it to get it done in September, October before the general election. That's not a conspiracy. That's the reality of how this stuff works.
Yeah, they're not going to do it at Thanksgiving and in December because A, there's a lot of work that happens right after the election, right? To get all of the tabulations done, all the reports
and this
out.
This election, we're like still going to be counting at Thanksgiving, I think.
Yeah, unfortunately. And so, you know, that they are tired at that after that point. Like, I can't reiterate enough how much local election boards and local election staffers, paid civilian staffers, do around this time. They are working. They're burning the midnight oil. They are working quite hard, and they're going to take a break. And then, you know, we forget about the election for a while. You know, the positions expire. And then they have to go and they get funding again for the next go around for the next, you know, congressional election 2 years later, staff back up again and whatnot. So, yeah, this is, I think, you know, just normal part of the election process. It's nothing conspiratorial. You know, this sort of voter list maintenance happens in every state, whether it's New York, you know, North Carolina, Hawaii, whatever.
Stephen Popick joining us. I want to ask you one more question. Put your economist hat back on now that I'll let you indulge your political commentary stuff for a moment. Here's something that's driving me nuts with this election. Everybody wants these two candidates to give a soundbite answer on how they're going to fix the prices of groceries. Mr. Economist, Dr. Popick, the president of the United States can't really do a whole lot about prices. And the few things he could probably do about consumer prices is probably going to make it worse. Is that statement accurate?
Absolutely accurate. So, and let me give a great example. The price of eggs, has been pretty high recently, right? Why have eggs been high? They've been high because a bunch of chickens died because of avian flu. I don't think the president can tell the avian flu, hey, can we chill out for a couple months? You know, that's just outside their bailiwick. I think, you know, a president can do a little bit to help the economy grow. A president can do quite a lot to destroy the economy with bad policies. I think that's where it is, you know. And so we have to be careful about what sorts of policies we go forward. You know, we're now talking again, and this is me putting on my economist hat, you know, there's conversations about tariffs. And by the way, tariffs, you know, these 10% across the board tariffs, which by the way, I agree with Scott Linnicombe from the Cato Institute. All it would do is basically raise prices for the consumers at the end of the day and probably lower income consumers. Sounds like the kind of people that, you know, we might want to help, not hurt. But it's not just Trump proposing these tariffs. You've got Jared Golden, who's got a tough fight out in Maine, right? He's on board with these tariffs. Tariffs are an easy answer to a complex question. And I would say for any policy, like, I don't know, I think, you know, capping student loan payments or something like that, something that's an easy answer. We've heard that from the Harris administration, from Biden Harris. So it's an easy answer, a complex problem. It's probably not the right answer, and it probably has a lot of perverse outcomes that occur on that. We should be careful, right? Simple solutions aren't simple, and they often hurt.
Would this be a good time for my rant about just make student loans bankruptcy eligible, because then that means it's no longer guaranteed money, and that would fix a lot of the higher education stuff? But would that be a good time for this rant?
I am not a student loan funding expert in any way, shape, or form. I couldn't tell you what that would do to student loans. But you know what? Rant on. As I said, you know, if it's a more complex answer, then, you know, I think you get closer. I want to say, you know, something that I really enjoyed reading this morning. I think even though he's retiring, I think Senator Romney has put out a really interesting and fact-based proposal around sort of child tax credits and family credits. I would encourage folks to read it. I think it's a solid blueprint for policies for the next administration, whoever that may be.
Yeah. Let me ask you that. Since you just brought it up, I want to actually bring this up. We vote for the candidates, Trump, Harris, Biden, Romney, Obama, McCain, Bush, go back however far you want to go. We put their names and faces to it because that's who gets covered. Who these people pick as economic advisors, same with foreign policies, same with monetary policies, same with education, pick whatever you want. The advisors they pick really, really matter because they're not experts on this. They're just going all, you know, they sit in a meeting, they give the idea, and then ideally the leader picks the best idea or compromise thereof and goes with it. What do we do to find out the economic team these people have behind them? Isn't that something we should pay a little bit more attention to? Because really the candidate's going to do whatever their economic advisors are. And they usually make a big deal of going, this is my economic advisor. This is who's advising me. These are the people around me. Isn't that something we should actually pay more attention to than we do?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, you can look at you can find out who their advisors are by going to the respective campaigns' websites. They'll have advisors. Or you can look at who's stumping for them in the media that's not a politician. And so you can also then look, you know, something I would tell people to do is, hey, you know, these economists probably published some stuff, like from the National Bureau of Econ Research, or they have been at the Council of Economic Advisors beforehand. Google them. See what kind of research they're doing, you know. I follow Jason Furman on Twitter. He was Obama's CA advisor. I think I follow Kevin Hassett, who was pretty sure he worked for President Trump at one point in time, although for a short cup of coffee, I think. You know, I follow them because I see what their research is, you know, what they're working on. If someone's being advised by Orrin Cass, I would recommend taking what he says with a grain of salt.
More than that, I would just bring the mine with the train. But anyway, Stephen Papad.
I just wanted to slam Orrin Cass.
All right, keep your personal grudges to yourself, y'all. You do your wrestling promo on other economists later. Stephen Popick joining us. One last economic question, we'll let you go though, but I think after the election, inevitably what happens is election year economics gets covered a certain way. As soon as the election's over, economics gets covered another way, which means not at all. However, we know traditionally there's two times of the year where people really, really pay attention to economics that are not election centric. And one of them comes up right after the election, and that is the Christmas holiday season. Thanksgiving onward, everybody talks economics because they all are going to be talking about the consumer end, and everybody buys a bunch of stuff, and the republic is going to fall if we don't spend X amount of money on Christmas, right? You've heard this every year. Let's preemptive that a little bit, because that will be the next economic, I don't want to call it a meta story or overarching theme, but once the election's over, that's the next economic story that will come out, right? The Christmas season. Do we have a handle on what kind of a holiday season we're going to have, end of the year season? Because economists are already projecting this stuff out. It's just we don't pay any attention to it.
I don't have a handle on what we're doing on Christmas, man. I got a 6-year-old kid. I don't even know what she's getting for Christmas right now.
That's maddeningly unhelpful. Sound more intelligent than that.
You know, I think that, I think you should be able to admit when you don't know the answer.
But you know what just I'm like saying, though. That's how we cover Christmas economics. Like, oh God, we're all economists now because the Christmas spending. It's amazing.
What we'll continue to, what I think we'll see, Black Friday is thankfully going to become less and less of a thing. Because we're all getting used to buying it off of Amazon. Or Temu now, apparently.
Well, let's not get into that.
Is there
an economic literacy problem among the populace? Look, they only get the news that's offered to them, but we do have a la carte news where you can get your own. And what's the economic literacy of America right now? Because I think it's a little, I don't think it's poor. Poor. I think a better way of saying it besides poor is it's very slanted to just whatever your feet. Look, we're talking vibe election because it's a vibe election. Yeah. I hate the term, but I don't have a better term for it. The vibe economy and vibe economics don't translate. I think that's actually more of a problem than just the illiteracy of it. Is like, oh, well, we only pay attention when it hurts, and then we get mad, and then it's just make it stop hurting, and then that's the extent. Is that a better way to lay it up?
Yeah, I think so. It's like, you know, something that always bothers me in political season is that, you know, politicians come out and they will say, we want to have this economic policy. We want to do this. But all they're doing is signaling what sort of bills they want to come forward, because most of the stuff has to come through the House and then the Senate to get to their desk. You know, they can say they want Fed policy to be this, but that's up to the Fed chair and the Fed committee. There's only so much that they can do, right, without it. So like, when you hear, you know, sort of like off the wall policy proposals, first you have to recognize, do they even have the power to do that, right? And I think that's where we failed before we even get to the economics and how well we understand them as a people. It's, I think we've forgotten our civics and what actually government does at each of its layers, what it can do, what it can't do. You know, we need to bring back, you know, the little, you know, it's just a bill. You know, we need to think about how that works. It's just the economy version of that, so we can know what the Fed is doing, you know, and what, you know, who writes tax policy. It's not the White House, it's the House submits the tax policy ideas. I think just knowing what presidential candidates can control, it was more about foreign trade, right? They can control that. They can control some trade agreements, things like that. But, you know, we lack that fundamental civics of what people can actually, what politicians can actually do, given what position they hold. And then in terms of economics, you know, I think it is a failing of, you know, the economics profession as a whole, that for a very long time, we were not approachable. We did not distill things down to have it make sense to folks that don't spend their time looking at a lot of fancy Greek and Roman letters. We're doing better at that now. Well, you know, there's some economists that have some decent podcasts, you know, trying to have better media out there, trying to explain things more simply, you know, but also still be accurate and not treat people like they're dumb, because people are not dumb. They're just not exposed to it. And so when you're not exposed to these things, it's a lot easier for you to miss something that's quite factual.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point you just put, is it's really hard to understand economics. And economists, not to compare because it's unfair, but, you know, it's kind of like scientists during COVID. Scientists were their own worst enemy during COVID because they're just not used to talking to the public. So you start putting these guys on TV and they come off really bad because they're academics and scientists, and they're not communication experts. Yeah. Economists have that same problem a lot of the time.
They don't teach community. You don't take communication classes when you get your econ PhD. I'll say that much. Andrew, do you know why I became an economist? We could end up on
the money, the money, fame, fortune, women and power and all that.
Absolutely not. I initially wanted to be a meteorologist, but then I realized an economist can be wrong more of the time and still keep their job.
Oh, okay, fine. That's enough out of you. Dr. Stephen Popick with the cheap puns and bad jokes. I admire the bravery of a man that is wearing an Atlanta Falcons shirt that wants to get jokey, because we can talk jokes. Good grief.
New Orleans Saints, that's a joke right there.
Oh, okay. Not my team, but I may have to defend them just on general principle there. But, you know, I admire a team that has the same championship record as the name of its owner. That's a good thing. I'll tell you this.
You know, we played the Chiefs last week, and but for a uncalled pass interference call at the end of the game in the end zone for the game-winning touchdown, you know, we played the Chiefs really close. I lost a bet with a colleague of mine, so I suffered that Monday with a team's background of Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce smiling and slapping a high five. Yeah, and I had to put up with that for 8 hours.
I think he's happily married, but maybe if we could get Cousins to date a pop star, maybe that would get you all over the hump. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe something. Anything.
Look, let's just try to get outcast at the Super Bowl first, okay?
Hey, the owner puts himself in the Ring of Honor. That'll fix everything. I mean, you're a pro wrestling fan. Was that not the biggest pro wrestling move ever? It's like, I'm going to put myself in my own Ring of Honor. And I'm picking on Arthur Blank. He does amazing stuff for the community in Atlanta. If you're not familiar with Atlanta, the dude has poured probably tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars into the community. So I'm not – he's a fine human being.
If you're a football fan, you have at least one thanks to give Arthur Blank and the Falcons organization. And that is the introduction or the reintroduction of fan-friendly pricing. And so even though, you know, ticket prices have been going crazy in the NFL, but Atlanta was sort of the first mover in the NFL to say, you shouldn't have to pay $10 for a Coke or $15 for a cheeseburger, right? Regular prices. And if you got a varsity burger from the varsity in Atlanta, great place to go. There's the varsity and Mercedes-Benz. You'll pay the same price for the hamburger there as you would at the regular varsity. That's a great move. And after Atlanta did it, a lot of other NFL franchises started to do that too.
Yeah.
So look, we'll take our lumps about 28-3, you know, but there's a couple things that we can be proud of. Fan-friendly pricing, Warrick Dunn being an amazing human being.
God, yes. Amazing.
You know, there's a couple of things that we can all take pride in.
Our buddy Donnell Suggs, who's been on this program, he's the editor of the Atlanta Voice. He actually goes to all the Atlanta Falcons game and the Atlanta soccer games and Mercedes-Benz too. He actually got to go, and he's got a post up. You can go see it on his social media where he got to do when they opened their preseason thing where they're like, here's all the new amenities, here's all the new food. It was amazing. the stuff that they're doing in Mercedes-Benz. So a little fun football because economy and politics are bad. Stephen Popick, let people know where they can keep up with you other than when they talk to you here. We'll keep having you back. And let folks know where they can follow you, my friend.
Yeah, come follow me on Twitter at MotoEconomist. And let's get back together in about a month and 2 weeks and see if anything that I said actually held up.
Yeah, hopefully we have the election wrapped up before Thanksgiving, but I've got my doubts. We'll see how it goes. Stephen Popick, appreciate you, sir. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Yep.
All the music on Her Tell is provided under a creative content license from MonsterCat.com. Somos la máquina.
Just got a free coffee with my EarnaFi points.
Your what?
The points I get with the new EarnaFi app from BP and Amoco. I got 250 for signing up and more every time I fill up or buy anything in the C-store.
Oh, can you use points for fuel?
Of course.
And discounts and deals?
On anything.
Oh, like chips?
Mm-hmm.
Sodas?
You got it.
The actual slushy machine.
Only what's actually for sale. But you do get double the points for the first 90 days. Just go to EarnaFiRewards.com to download the app.
Available at participating locations only. App content is subject to change.